Hello and welcome to the Right Dishonourable podcast, as truthful as resources permit. Jazza, how much in favour of a 10 p.m. curfew would you say you are, not just for the rest of the year, but forever?
I feel like this was a question, you asked me a similar question, but specifically pertaining to men, as the cold open a while ago, Jimmy. And I think I can't remember what I answered there, but we've never had a 10 p.m. curfew.
That's, yeah, that is true. But okay,
have we? So where is this coming from, sweetheart? Are you all right?
Well, I think the previous instance of this was relating to the Sarah Everard case.
Everard stuff,
which
yeah.
Which is now actually just in the process of concluding. But this particular question this time around is inspired by an Ipsos Mori survey into British support for COVID restrictions going forward beyond July 19th, and also, more interestingly, perpetually until the end of time. So one of the things that they've found is that around a fifth of the country would be in favour of imposing a 10 p.m. curfew just forever, just going forward, with no limits on it whatsoever.
I'd love to see the demographic breakdown of that, because I feel like none of those people are going to the pub.
Well, interestingly, a similar proportion, so around 25%, are in favour of nightclubs and casinos being closed again forever.
They still haven't been opened. The poor things.
So, Jazza, we are going to be talking about the lifting of lockdown, which is due on July 19th. Are you excited?
Excuse me, can you call it by its proper name?
What is its proper name?
Freedom Day, apparently.
Okay, we're going to talk about
but
Freedom
it's going
Day.
To be it's going to be from government sources. It is going to be a cautious unlocking, but it's also Freedom Day. So make sure that you hold those two potentially conflicting framings of the day, of the ending of all restrictions, in your head at the same time, and make sure you don't get confused. All right.
Well, they say a measure of a first-class intelligence is to be able to hold two conflicting things in your head at the same time, Jazza. So I suppose we'll
all know that Boris Johnson has got a fucking galaxy brain, don't we?
I think he's quite a smart guy, to be fair. He just has problems with his character. Is that unfair? I feel that's a fair assessment.
I'm surprised that you've gone so hardcore there. Not allegedly he has problems. No, he just does have problems with his character.
Well, I think it's been quite well alleged at this stage of the game. I think it's
no,
been,
don't pull back, Jimmy.
It's been quite well established. Including on Dominic Cummings' Substack, which I've still not subscribed to, but I am reading bits and pieces as it dribbles through to the mainstream press.
I reckon that journalists expensing the subscription to the Substack is a more cost-efficient... And then writing about the stories that he releases on Substack is a more cost-efficient way of me following what Dominic Cummings is writing about than me actually subscribing myself.
That's true. Yeah, very, very clever. So we are going to be talking for our first topic about Freedom Day, as Jazza put it. Second up, we're going to be talking about the US decision to leave Afghanistan, finally.
And the British,
and presumably...
We were there too, don't forget us!
Presumably other allied forces. So Joe Biden has...
I think it's only the two of us left, isn't it?
Is there any forces?
And then there's some UN presence, but that's about it.
There's probably a few odds and ends from other, like Australia, I'd imagine, maybe have a few men there.
They're probably sent over a platypus or something strap it to the front of a tank. Or
do they have platypuses in Australia? They have all sorts.
That's where they're from. They're a marsupial.
You mean they have a pouch?
And they lay eggs. How do you not? Yeah.
I'm not an expert in Australia's wildlife, I'm afraid.
I think the whole point... Yeah, platypuses are... Aren't they?
I don't know. You said it with a great deal
of
confidence.
Well, this is completely off. Platypus. Hold on.
This is very
important. Yeah, Eastern Australia.
Okay. I wasn't doubting you. You doubted yourself. And
well, you seemed quite certain about it, to be honest.
Anyway... So, you know, not related to platypuses or any other kind of marsupial, Joe Biden, the US president, has set a date of the 11th of September 2021 to withdraw all US troops from Afghanistan.
Although I believe it's now been pulled forward or moved forward a little bit to the 31st of August is the latest reporting on that.
How I see. Well, this report I'm reading is from 2 days ago. So, you know, 48 hours is a long time in politics, clearly.
Oh, it's an eon in politics, indeed.
But I mean, the 11th of September is a particularly resonant date for America's involvement in Afghanistan. Perhaps
Donald Trump released a statement saying that it should be a sacred day of remembrance. Very stoic, actually, for Trump.
Yeah,
where he released it, I don't really know.
Oddly.
Well, it's because he's not live tweeting anymore. People are actually writing his statements for him. but I think I might actually agree. I'm not sure why you would want it to coincide it with September 11th. It seems like a very deliberate use of that date, but we'll get to talk about that. Of the last 20 years, Jimmy, of the United States and its allies being in Afghanistan, how would you grade it?
What sort of grading system are we using here? Is this an out of 10?
Like A, B, C, like A plus.
Oh my God, we're going old school grading here, so not 1 to 9, but the old letters.
Yeah, I don't acknowledge the new grading system for GCSEs.
That'll be interesting when you come to interview people going through the schooling system currently.
I'm planning on hiring no people under the age of 18. Thank you very much.
Well, one day they'll be over 18 with all their numbers.
But, yeah, I will ignore them. No Zoomers, thank you.
In answer to your question, though, I guess the only question is whether it's been a total failure or an almost total failure. That's probably like somewhere between E and U, I think.
U was unmarkable.
Yeah, I was never entirely sure whether
I don't think it's necessarily unmarkable, but it's certainly close to that. And so I think like an E or an F probably is what I'd give it. Like, it's certainly not a pass.
Yeah, well,
because most of the conversations about whether or not the withdrawal from Afghanistan is good seems to be focused around how long it's going to take for the Taliban to be able to overthrow the current government, rather than if it's going to be able to overthrow the current government. And those seem to be failures of the initial mission from 20 years ago.
Yes, I think we would. I think most people can probably agree that, although the US presidency is trying not to frame it quite in those terms. But yeah, we can get more into that later. Jazza, what's our third and final topic for this here podcast?
It's coming home. It's coming home.
Jazza, we don't have the song rights for this. You're going to get us in trouble.
It's coming home.
We're going to get flagged up by a podcasting algorithm.
It's coming home. It's coming. I have been whipped up in the nationalism of Euro fever. The UK, that's not what I was playing. England have reached a major international final for the first time in 55 years. Yes, we haven't reached a final. Well, the men's team haven't reached a final since 1966. Remember when we jokingly say to Germans, two World Wars, one World Cup? That one World Cup is the last time that we were ever even within spitting distance of winning any kind of silverware as a nation. We are recording this on the day of the final. Kickoff is going to be at 8 o'clock at Wembley, and we're going to be taking on Italia. So football is either coming home or it's going Rome.
How long have you been working on that?
I am not the only person. It's all over Twitter, to be
okay.
fair.
Well, I wouldn't know such things being absent from Twitter.
Sure, yeah, we believe you. there has been much spoken about the calibre of the team, not just on the pitch, but of them as individuals, the quiet paternalistic attitude and demeanour of Gareth Southgate, the manager, the fact that they continue to take the knee to promote equality, despite the fact that... England, a lot of England fans seem to be the absolute worst, actually. We're in the process of being disciplined by UEFA, who run the tournament, for booing the Danish team as they sang their national anthem, because there were a majority English fans there because it was at Wembley. There was also an investigation around fans trying to shine a laser pointer light into the face of the Danish goalie while he was about to take a penalty. Save a penalty, which he did and then didn't.
Well, he saved the penalty and the rebound.
And then didn't.
Yeah. So...
I think I described it incredibly well, Jimmy. And there's also a load of stories of Danish fans being abused by England fans. So there is kind of like this duality of a resurgence of pride. And like, give me a chance to get behind a flag any day of the week and I will do so. Thank you very much. It is why I love shit like Eurovision and the Olympics. It's because I get to feel like we're represented by somebody other than Boris fucking Johnson. I'm having a lovely time watching the boys play, and I'm having a lovely time feeling like there's like some positivity in our representation, albeit fraying around the edges. Do you care, Jimmy?
I've enjoyed the two matches I've watched.
Okay.
I suppose I'm not
You've
super
missed
committed.
Some really great. There's been some fantastic matches.
Well, I've been busy, Jazza. I've got stuff on, you know.
No, you haven't. Don't lie to me. I know your schedule.
It's very tricky, you know. It's difficult. Mm-hmm. I was legit on holiday during the Ukrainian match, so yeah.
You know that there are televisions even when on holiday.
Yeah, but the missus doesn't really want to watch the football, I'm afraid.
So you'll sit down and watch Too Hot to Handle, but you won't sit down as a couple and watch the England team make history.
I like that you've referenced our bonus segment, for the last episode and for this one. Or was it the one before last? Uh-huh. I forget. So that, you know, that's a good chance to talk about our Patreon account a little bit, play some music, mm-hmm. and get on with the main podcast.
Oh, glorious.
If you are a fan of the Right Dishonourable podcast, you can support us by going to patreon.com/rightdishonourable. There you can subscribe to us on an episodic basis, which gives you access to exclusive segments that we do not release to anybody else. Our current patrons include Alexander Wood, Andrew Kilpatrick, David Preston, Gemma Cumming, John O, Matt, and Michael Costa. Thank you very much for supporting the show. Also, if you don't think you're getting enough from me on this podcast, you can read my weekly newsletter on politics and other things at jdenichols.substack.com. Also, you can watch Jazza play Pokemon on his YouTube gaming channel, which for some reason can be found at youtube.com/JazzaInChina. That's probably enough advertising for one episode, so now on with the show.
Jimmy, how are you going to be celebrating Freedom Day? Perhaps by burning your mask, coughing in the face of a stranger on public transport, maybe shoving your face into the armpit of a friend of yours in a nightclub. What have you got on the cards?
Well, I mean, the things you described is just a normal Thursday night for me, so I think I will need to come up with something a bit more special.
I mean, what happens between you and your partner is, I don't think should be brought into the public realm, Jimmy. Calm down.
Oh, thanks for that. I think I'm going to be doing nothing, because the pubs have been open for a while, so, you know...
Have you continued to go? What's been your attitude recently, seeing as we're now, cases are now higher than they were when we went into lockdown in November? Look like they're going to go past the peak that we were at in January.
I think for me personally, this is going to sound like I'm doing a Billy Big Bollocks, just talking up myself like a lockdown skeptic, but I've never been like that bothered by my own personal safety in relation to coronavirus, because I thought the odds of it killing me were quite small. So that aspect hasn't bothered me too much, and I've got one sort of medically vulnerable person in my life, who I've sort of who I'm talking about, my mum, who I've deliberately not gone to see, or like if I have gone round, I've just stayed in the garden mostly. But she's double vaccinated now, so I'm sort of less worried about her. So I mean, I guess the numbers are concerning, but if you believe what the government say, they've severed the link between caseload and hospitalizations.
Oh, there was a clarification this morning.
Yeah?
It hasn't been severed, the link. There has been... Wait, what was the word that a weakening person said? The link has been weakened between hospitalizations and deaths and the vaccine. Wait. Yes. You know what I mean.
Yeah, I think we know what you mean. To be honest with you, I've been going to the pub too much, and I need to cut back just for the state of my general health rather than the health of the nation.
Oh, Jesus Christ.
But the nightclub thing, this might surprise listeners and you, Jazza, but I'm not really a nightclub person.
I'm shocked.
I mean, obviously, down at the casinos every day, practically, when they were open, so that's very exciting. More opportunities to lose money.
Is that a joke? Okay, cool.
betting is obviously...
Are we going to have to address your gambling problem, Jimmy?
Yeah, and my drinking problem, apparently. This is turning into quite a confessional for me. I don't know. I personally, to sort of go back to your original question about Freedom Day, I still don't really think the government knows what it's doing. So I'm quite hesitant about all of this stuff. I mean, there's obviously one of the big debates is the extent to which people will or won't wear masks going out of July 19th. And the government's been pretty ambiguous about it.
I think it's been pretty clear that, to be honest, it's kind of rolling back its bullishness now, saying it's recommended that you keep your mask on, but in public places, but it's no longer a necessity. And I am sorry, but I have the amount of people I've seen with those badges of medically exempt, and I'm like, you either printed that off or you bought it off of a dodgy website, didn't you? I don't believe for a fucking second that you are exempt from wearing a mask, Linda, wandering around fucking Westfield. I'm speaking about one specific couple that I saw in Westfield, and I was like, I've never seen that design of a badge saying I'm exempt.
I just remember, even during the height of lockdown, I would see in our local supermarket these like 20-something couples just wandering around inside Sainsbury's, and I was a bit like, okay, you know, there is a chance that you're both medically exempt, but it does seem more likely on the whole that you're just taking the piss, right? Mm-hmm. Like, and that's true for like most people. I mean, I kind of feel if you see an elderly person who's not wearing one, you're like, there's, you know, it's more likely that they're medically exempt for some reason, because, you know, older people tend to have more health problems. But I think a lot of people have been taking the piss for a long time. And I think mask compliance has steadily declined since the, you know, masks were introduced as mandatory, I think. Mm-hmm. I mean, maybe it became a bit more common during the winter lockdown, but people really don't seem that bothered now, I would say.
I'm bothered by people not being bothered. I'll be honest, I judge people hugely if you are deciding to not, like, it's a slight inconvenience to wear a mask, and it saves other people more than it does you. It looks after other people more than it does you, and it seems incredibly selfish to me. And I can't help but feel like I'm incredibly judgmental of those people. And it makes me I just had my second jab 2 days ago, 3 days ago. And so I have to wait like 2 weeks. But I just don't want to catch COVID. Like, regardless as to whether or not I'm a non-vulnerable age group, or I don't really have any other ailments that would mean that I'm likely to get hospitalized, I just don't want to catch it. And I think that is reasonable when it's pretty scary. Like, it can potentially be scary. Apparently, it was something like 1 in 6 they found. I've heard 1 in 6 people get some form of long COVID. So still have like viral fatigue up to 3 months after their initial infection. And I just don't want that. Yeah, and so I'm kind of having a self-imposed lockdown at the moment. And Freedom Day, for me, is certainly not going to be Freedom Day. I'm going to stay inside. Rather sensible. Thank you very much.
What do you make of this trend that some government ministers are sort of warning about, that people are going to start deleting their NHS apps on the 19th? Because you'll no longer be required to check into venues.
Yeah,
and that kind of
there's conflicting evidence around this, right? Like, apparently downloads are still up. Like, the app is still continuing to be downloaded. But is that people who have deleted the app and then downloaded it again? Because, they like, in order to get into a venue, they log in and then afterwards they delete it and then they download it again in order to get into another venue or something. Because some of the venues have been pretty good at being relatively strict around what they like, having people actively check in. I've certainly been into like a restaurant that doesn't make you log in and stuff like that.
Yeah, same.
I think I get the I think that people probably have the impression that the app is going to be redundant after the 19th, no?
Well,
because that's kind of the impression that I have.
Yeah, I mean, if people, so if I've
they
got,
keep on saying no restrictions, and I assume, and self-isolation seems like a restriction.
Yeah, so actually sort of connected to the app thing, people, I've heard many more reports just from, like, you know, people at work and friends and that sort of thing, of other people being pinged by the app to be told to self-isolate. And so
I know a lot of people, it's in our age group, a lot of people, and for listeners, we're in our late teens, early 20s.
this is the fakest news that's ever been broadcast on this podcast.
We have a lot. I've had a lot of people who are I know who are our age who have been pinged and have had to self isolate.
Well, this is the thing. If you delete the app, in theory, you can't be pinged, right? Because I mean,
I think I may have accidentally gone around the app, because I only have Bluetooth on when I'm using the app.
Yeah, I do the same thing.
But that is like what I usually do for all apps. It wasn't like deliberate, but I was like, is that going to stop me from being associated with particular places where I'm close to people? No idea.
So the way the app works, right, is that you turn, in theory, you're supposed to have Bluetooth on all the time. And then as you're going about your day, if you spend a decent amount of time within close proximity to somebody who then tests positive for COVID, you'll get pinged, and then you'll have to self-isolate.
Well,
so if you turn Bluetooth off, that element of the app doesn't work, basically, as
great.
I understand it.
Well, I have not been using the app correctly.
Well,
have I?
I mean, if you turn... I think I'm right in saying if you leave your Bluetooth on, it will drain your battery, right? Cause,
well, yeah, I never have my Bluetooth on.
So it's actually...
I only have my Bluetooth on when I, like, I'm using wireless headphones and stuff, which isn't very often.
Yeah, I mean, I what I tend to do, because you can't check into a venue without turning Bluetooth on, so I turn it on, check into the venue, and turn it off, which is I'm certain not the way the government wants you to use it.
100% is not, yeah.
I mean, they've also said that they're going to reduce the sensitivity of that Bluetooth feature, I think.
That
so,
we don't use.
Well, you already don't use, but other people, presumably, you know, these people getting pinged must be people that have Bluetooth on more
they
than
must
we
be,
do.
Yeah.
By and large. So yeah, I don't. But yeah, I mean, I think there's been significant enough concern that people are going to delete the app that, you know, so some people want measures to oblige people to have the app. And actually,
I don't understand how that's enforceable.
Well, I don't think it is. I think it's just talk. I mean, we're actually, in some ways, we're at the middle of the scale in terms of, like, we use the app to check in and then we turn off our Bluetooth, because there are some people who refuse to download the app. I mean, some of these people are just lockdown skeptics in general, but some people just don't want to be pinged at all. And so they'd rather just write their information onto a sheet of paper or whatever.
Yeah.
So, you know.
There's been some projections that once Freedom Day, so puerile. Once Freedom Day,
it's because you don't love freedom, Jazza. You're an anti-patriotic Ramona, anti-freedom, lockdown. I don't know where I'm going with
this. Shut up, you twat.
I'm just using words. It's because you hate this country,
just
Jasser, isn't it?
That's
what's really going on here. You don't like this country. You're talking Britain down.
I hate you so much. There's been some of the projections of what cases and hospitalizations are going to look like have suggested that we will reach a peak of 2,500 hospitalizations a day, potentially.
Right.
The government seems to think that the stays in hospital of those hospitalized is going to be shorter, and they're going to be less. There's going to be less need of stuff like intensive care, the most intensive care that was really stretched during the 2-3 peaks of the pandemic that we've had so far. What seems to be happening is they're going for herd immunity, aren't they?
Yeah,
really?
They
can't say herd immunity because now it's a naughty word. But they're hoping that exposing all of the young people who haven't yet been vaccinated to the virus so that they get natural immunity, and all of the older vaccinated people who would have otherwise been hospitalized or died from the virus, that those two factors together are going to mean that we're going to reach a peak of infections, but not have nearly as many deaths in the next couple of months over summer, so that any kind of peak doesn't coincide with a flu peak that we're expecting to see in the winter this year, right? I can't shake the fact that they are rolling the dice on people under the age of, like, 40. They really do not care about us. And it also, that's one thing, that's just my feelings being hurt, Jimmy. But there's also, surely these circumstances are the prime circumstances in which a variant of the virus develops that is going to gain immunity to the vaccine. Because there's going to be high numbers of the virus circulating in the population and being exposed to those who have been vaccinated. Because of the large volume of the virus, there's going to be more of a chance that a mutation that is resistant to the virus is going to be able to take to the vaccine is going to be able to take off.
Yeah,
that scares the shit out of me, because then we're back at square one, innit?
Yes, and then yes. Although I think that the sense I got was that if new variants emerge that are resistant to the vaccine or can overcome the vaccine, it should be easier to develop, new types of vaccine to deal with those variants than it was to create the original vaccine in the first place.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that, assuming that is true, and I've remembered that correctly, that is, I think, some grounds for consolation. But
I think it depends on the type of vaccine.
Right.
I believe the mRNA ones in theory would be easier to manufacture and to adjust, whereas the normal vaccines like AstraZeneca I think would have to go completely through trials again, because they have to get another dead bit of the virus.
Yeah, I mean, I think I agree with your general concerns there, Jazza, but in the vein of Boris Johnson,
did you agree with me?
Yes, I did. In the vein of Boris Johnson attacking Keir Starmer at PMQs, what's your alternative?
Wait until you have higher levels of full vaccination in the population, like what Israel did.
But that's, as you say, that would mean that we'd be opening up later in the summer, and that would also coincide with the reopening of schools for the new academic year, among other things, and we'd be closer to winter. So there are downsides to that approach, right?
There are, but I think I would prefer that because then you have much less transmissibility of the virus. That's the choice that I would make anyway. I ain't an epidemiologist.
Neither of us are. I think there are risks to both approach, the one you outlined and the one the government is going with. But it's hard to escape the sense that the government has somewhat reverted to conservative type and to the the kind of attitudes that we saw at the start of the, you know, the first lockdown, where they just kind of want to let it rip a little bit more. I mean, you know,
let it rip is such a horrible visualization, isn't it?
It does invoke farting, apart from anything else.
It's equal parts farting and also a chainsaw.
Interesting.
Which I think in many ways does quite nicely symbolise COVID-19.
Yeah. So before we move on, I do want to come back to this Ipsos Mori poll, which we touched on in the introduction.
Okay, cool. Yeah, you love this.
I do love this. I think it's...
What was the N of this study?
You asking how many people were surveyed?
Yeah.
I do not have that information in front of me, I'm afraid. Oh. Ipsos Mori is a decent pollster. I would guess it would be at least 1,000 people.
When you bring polls to me, Jimmy, can you make sure that you have all of the background information in the future?
I will. I'll do my homework properly next time. Jazza, I apologise.
Good boy,
So in this poll, which was commissioned by The Economist, they've looked at like what the British public will support in terms of COVID restrictions, along three different kind of axes, if you like. So it's for a month after July 19th, which is Freedom Day, until COVID-19 is under control globally. The results for these two categories are quite similar. So it's not really worth fixating on the differences between the two of them. And then this further category, which is permanently, regardless of any COVID-19 status. People actually want masks in shops and on public transport. Like, it's between 60% and 70% until, you know, for a month after July 19th is 70%, and then until COVID-19 is under control globally is around 65%. Similar numbers for 10-day quarantine on return from abroad, similar numbers for foreign travel only with proof of vaccination. So although, you know, we have said that, I mean, I think we've both observed in our own lives something of a decline in terms of COVID restriction compliance, there does still seem to be a public appetite for it, at least until COVID is actually sorted out, or at least for a little bit longer.
Mm. I want to know who thinks all of that.
Demographically speaking,
because,
you mean?
Yeah, because you could make the argument either way, right? Like, the young, you may have young people who are more in favour of vaccines. Oh, sorry, not vaccines, of continuing the restrictions because of the protection of their health. But then you could also argue it the other way, that they see it as not a hugely risky thing for them to get COVID. Mm. And so they want to lift them. And you could make the opposite thing for old people, where most of them will have larger houses, will own their houses, will maybe they'll be on pensions, or they'll be much more economically stable, and so have been able to weather lockdowns a lot longer. But then also, do they now feel a bit more cavalier about it because they have, most of them have been fully vaccinated? I'd be fascinated to see how that breaks down demographic lines.
Yeah, that, I mean, that sort of aspect of it is interesting, because throughout lockdown, essentially, you know, that young people have been asked to sacrifice their freedoms to largely protect, you know, the vulnerable and the elderly and so on. There's been a huge kind of generational shifting of burdens, basically. So that aspect of it is interesting, you know, sort of relating to that. I was talking about some of the numbers for people who permanently want to impose restrictions regardless of COVID. I think I'll run down a few numbers in a second, but I think there's obviously some people in Britain who have very authoritarian instincts anyway. I mean, it's definitely a good 10-15%, I would say, of the country who actually just want people to have less freedom generally in terms of doing certain things. I guess also there's probably people who are just a bit more afraid of, you know, coronaviruses in general, respiratory diseases in general, the kind of epidemics that... I think some people are probably imagining a more epidemic world, basically, where there are risks of these things, and they want permanent measures to mitigate against those risks. So that's how I'm interpreting these numbers. But 40% of people want there to be masks in shop and on public transport permanently. It's around 35% want that 10-day quarantine on return from abroad. 45% want foreign travel only with proof of vaccination. 35% want social distancing in theatres, pubs and sports grounds. There's a couple of, I mentioned the nightclubs and casinos at 25% and 10 p.m. curfew, which is insane to me at 20% of the population.
Why is the idea of a curfew so insane to you?
I think for some reason I have such a firm link in my head between autocratic regimes and curfews. There's all, like, if somebody tells you you can't go to the pub, obviously that is bad. If somebody tells you you literally can't leave your house at certain times of the day, you know, this is beyond, like, I get the kind of self-isolation thing and that requirement, but someone's just saying, just as a default option, you cannot leave your house at 10 p.m. Mm. I mean, those are the kind of measures that are imposed in, like, war, you know, war-torn places and, you know.
And Paris.
What, right now? Or
just... Well, no, just in general. They love a curfew.
Yeah, and, I mean, going back to the contact tracing thing in pubs and restaurants, 35% of people want that to continue permanently. It's just, I mean, obviously at the start of this pandemic, there was a lot of scoffing about, like, imposing lockdowns in general. But clearly, there's a huge appetite in Britain for restrictions on people's freedom in order to mitigate against epidemic risks and other things. I just think it's really interesting.
Love that.
Yeah, I think something for people to chew on anyway. But speaking of war-torn places, Jazza, we are going to be talking...
Oh, very good. That was actually not a bad segue.
Yeah, it would have been better had I said it properly without stumbling and had you not highlighted the fact that I was doing an awkward segue.
Oh, yeah, no, I've got to derail the whole thing as much as possible.
Very much so. So the US are going to be withdrawing from Afghanistan.
Have withdrawn to
a significant degree. Yeah, they have
a significant degree.
Yeah. So, I mean, you said it was by the end of August. The date of the 11th of September was kind of floated as well previously. And so, after the total pullout, the US is expected to keep 650 to 1,000 troops in Afghanistan to guard its big embassy. Apparently, I think it's the biggest in the world. This is, and I think it's in Kabul. If memory serves, and they're also going to be, you know, guarding other key government installations. So it's not the case that there will be no US military presence in Afghanistan from September onwards, but it is the case that they've effectively declared the war is over and they're going to pull out. And as you said, the Taliban are expected to take control of take control of a lot of places. There's a report I read in the Wall Street Journal that says there's another report from the US intelligence community which concludes that Afghanistan could collapse as soon as 6 months
after the American military withdrawal.
That seems, I mean, you know, we talked about how we'd rate the success of this particular foreign adventure, if we can use that phrase.
Significant prediction by the... It was the Afghan papers, wasn't it? Is that what they were called?
It doesn't say it here, but yeah, I can... one thing that you can't accuse America of skimping on is spending on their foreign intelligence services. And, you know, it's not... Obviously, they do get things wrong, sometimes significantly. But if they're saying that they expect within half a year the country will have reverted to how it was, you know, pre-America invading, basically, or at least, you know, the Taliban are going to take control of significant... I mean, they've already got control of significant areas of the country anyway.
The Afghan papers, I think there's something different to the report that you were talking about, but they were leaked a couple of years ago, and they essentially showed that high-ranking officials... This would have been under the Trump administration were generally of the opinion that the war was unwinnable and that they were actively trying to keep that from the public. The report also found that up to 40% of US aid to Afghanistan over the last 20 years has ended up in the pockets of corrupt officials, warlords, criminals and insurgents.
You're talking about financial aid money, basically.
Yeah. That's pretty damn embarrassing, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, I think that there were periods during the American occupation of Afghanistan where, you know, things like education for girls and sort of general stability were better than what they're going to be once the US has pulled out full time. But I think if you look at the situation from the start of the war in 2001 to the finish this year, I think you can only conclude it has been a total waste of money and resources. Like, the failure is actually pretty absolute, to be honest with you. Mm-hmm. Like, the country is... the country is effectively no more stable than it was prior to America entering, and in some ways I think you could argue it's less stable.
And that expectation that the Taliban will, well, the current Afghan government will fall, assumedly to the Taliban, means that we're going to have to get used to dealing with a Taliban regime in Afghanistan, right? And they are apparently not as bad as they were maybe 20 years ago, but certainly not the the greatest when it comes to civil liberties, women's education, etc. And their general opinion of the United States.
I mean, would you have a good opinion of the United States if you were?
To be fair, most people don't. If you look at the world in general, most people don't have a good view of the United States. So that was maybe a silly thing for me to say.
I suppose in many ways it's interesting, just because for a long time America had this attitude of, you know, we can't allow ungoverned spaces in the world because they will, allow opportunities for terrorist groups to grow. I mean, this is kind of the justification for invading Iraq as well as Afghanistan. That it had to be brought under control just for the domestic defense of the US, basically. And you can interpret it in various ways, but they've either decided it's not worth the effort to do that, or it's not possible, alternatively, that actually they just can't bring these kind of places under control because they just lack the will or the strategies or whatever else to do so. But, I think in US military terms anyway, they've been moving away from kind of counterinsurgency and counterterrorist stuff to, what's called great power competition. So, the American rivalries with China principally, but also Russia to a lesser degree.
Certainly Russia in that part of the world, right?
Yeah, I think so. Some people have speculated that with the US withdrawing, that China and Russia will take more of an interest in what goes on in Afghanistan and feel they have more freedom to maneuver. It probably won't be the case that Afghanistan isn't exposed to, foreign interference by great powers. We probably will still see more of that. And obviously the US is still maintaining some tiny presence there.
Yeah, the foreign interference, especially from China, looks very, very different from what we would usually consider foreign interference when we look at the last 20 years of Western foreign policy.
Mm.
China tends to be much more... what's it called? Pork barrel?
Pork barrel politics.
It's basically pork barrel politics, where they will promise investment and access to an economy, which often will mean that country siding with China on particular international diplomatic issues, stuff like, what's happening in Xinjiang with the Uyghur population and sovereignty of Tibet and Hong Kong and all of those kinds of things.
Pork barrel politics, just to be clear, is when in a democratic system somebody says vote for me and I'll give you some investment from the government, or
it's just bribery.
Yeah, so this is
just bribery of nations now.
I think the significant thing with China compared to the US is that when the US actually engages the probably an overly polite way of describing the situation in Afghanistan, but when it engages with countries, it often says, we'll give you this, but you have to make your country more like ours, i.e. you have to progress towards democratic norms and respect human rights and as we conceive of them and so on. China is much more ideologically agnostic, basically, about it. It says, we see strategic
benefits.
It's
not trying to spread communism. They're not Trotskyists.
No, they're not. They'll say, we'll help you build this dam or this piece of infrastructure or whatever. And there are no particular ideological strings attached to that. You just have to, as you say, support us in some of our international interests and goals. But beyond that, you can keep running your country as you see fit, basically. And I think, in general, that's a lot more attractive to most countries, right? It's a better deal.
They're winning that argument across a lot of the continent of Africa at the moment, where China has made really great inroads, because investment and support from the Chinese government does not come with the insistence of you being a democracy, as an example.
I mean, I think linked to that, I think there is a general sense that America is just not as willing to, it's not as willing to go to war as it once was. You know, mm-hmm. Certainly in the early noughties, the Iraq and Afghanistan invasions showed an almost, in a way, impressive willingness to actually go abroad and fight. But yeah, nowadays, I don't think people expect America to intervene, certainly not to the same extent. And that has huge implications for foreign policy. I mean, one of the most obvious ones and a subject that keeps coming up of late is whether, if hypothetically mainland China were to invade Taiwan, how the US would respond.
Because the US actually has a mutual aggression pact with Taiwan.
Yeah, mutual defense, I guess. Or
mutual. I've got your back, mate. Pact.
yeah, pretty much. And you know, I think some of this talk of like.
Well, I think one of the reasons of the. And well, not one of the reasons, but one of the trends that this Afghanistan final withdrawal is kind of like representative of is this desire to shift to the Pacific for the US, which would allow them to have more of a say in the Asia Pacific region and to be a counter to somewhere like China and maybe be in a better position to do stuff like potentially defend Taiwan. Who knows? Mm.
Well, I don't know that it's become more likely recently that America would invade Taiwan. I mean, the Chinese military build-up...
China would invade Taiwan.
Yeah, sorry. I don't know that the US would come riding to Taiwan's rescue necessarily. I think there are significant questions over that. I mean, obviously for China, invading Taiwan would be a huge gamble, even though they've become more militarily powerful.
I think that there are enough powerful Taiwanese Americans in American civil society on both sides of the aisle that it would be next to impossible for the US to be able to respond to an invasion of Taiwan.
You mean not to respond?
Not to respond, yeah. But I like China's posturing around Taiwan specifically is really quite scary,
yeah,
actually.
Yeah, it is.
But I think as long as there is that at least perceived guarantee of American defense, it is just rhetoric that allows Xi Jinping to cement himself as kind of like he really is the most powerful premier that the Chinese Communist Party has had since probably Deng Xiaoping in the 80s. And that's what he wants. He just wants kind of like a bit of a Winnie the Pooh cult.
Yeah, he loves that nickname. He's a big fan.
He does. Yeah, I'm never getting into the country ever again, am I?
Yeah, I think some people seem to think that the invasion of Taiwan is inevitable, which I think is overstating it. But I think it's a significant risk. And if they were to do it, and if they were to attempt it, whether or not it succeeded, that would be the biggest event in like global geopolitics for, you know, since the fall of the Berlin Wall, basically. It would be seismic,
I agree.
Right? And I think that America's foreign misadventures in Iraq and Afghanistan, and also, you know, some of its ineffectiveness in Syria as well, it's just contributed to the impression that America might not respond to Taiwan. Whereas I think if China felt that America definitely would respond to an invasion of Taiwan, it would not be considering doing it, like, because, mm-hmm. you know, they're not stupid, right?
Mm-hmm. Like, America is still head and shoulders the largest military might in the world. Like,
they are, although there are some questions as to how long that situation is going to continue, because I mean, particularly on like the naval side, China has been building up its forces. They've certainly got a manpower advantage, which is somewhat significant.
Women.
Well, yeah, Matt, people power advantage. So I think, I mean, apart from Afghanistan being a failure in its own right, I think it's massively undermined confidence in America. Just in America being a reliable force in global politics, I think, which is not good for the West, but I also think it's not good for the world as a whole.
Final question. Will we look back at Afghanistan as bad or worse than something like the Vietnam War?
So a lot has been made of the fact that the Afghanistan conflict is America's longest war. I can't remember how long they were in Vietnam for.
It was over a decade, I believe.
Yeah. I think the thing is that the Vietnam War has left a more significant scar on American society than the Afghanistan War did. I mean, there were more American troops involved in Vietnam than in Afghanistan.
Oh my God. Vietnam technically was also 20 years.
Right.
Okay. From the 1st of November, according to Wikipedia, 1st of November 1955 to the fall of Saigon on the 30th of April 1975.
Okay, well, yeah, it clearly depends.
So just under 20 years.
Depends how you measure it, I guess, to some degree, which is true of a lot of wars. But, I think Vietnam...
Christ, it started in the 50s? I didn't even... Wow. Wow.
Yeah, it's not just the time span, I think. It's also that Afghanistan never involved conscription from the American point of view. I think even if you look at the sort of films that have been made about Vietnam compared to the films... I'm actually struggling to think of a film based around America's involvement in Afghanistan. I'm sure they exist, but I think just culturally it's less significant.
Jarhead... Black Hawk Down isn't that.
No,
that's Afghanistan.
No.
Jarhead
was the one I was thinking might be related to Afghanistan. I couldn't remember. But yeah, I culturally, I think it matters a lot less. And so, I mean, to some of the commentary I've been reading around Afghanistan, but you know,
Zero Dark Thirty.
Well, Zero Dark Thirty, I think, is about the assassination of Osama bin Laden, isn't it? Am I wrong about that? So that obviously is related, but
yeah,
as I was kind
War
of
War Dogs. I'm just reading.
You're just reading films to me now.
Whiskey Tango Foxtrot with Tina Fey in it, apparently.
But there's
American Sniper.
Yeah, although that's not really about Afghanistan as such. That's
the
more
Valley
about...
of Elah.
I've not even heard of that actually.
Oh, I had Hurt Locker.
I guess, you know, irrespective, I mean, if you think about the war films about Vietnam, you've got like Platoon, Apocalypse Now, you know, these are kind of like iconic American films. I'm not really sure the same applies to the films
Zero Dark Thirty got an Oscar?
I mean, do you disagree that Vietnam was more culturally salient than Afghanistan?
No, I'm just being a dick.
You are just being, wow, that's just your standard thing on this podcast, right? But as I was kind of saying, like some people say that if the American public had been more engaged in Afghanistan, it might have been easier for the Americans to get a good outcome from the war. It was the fact that they, to some degree, weren't that interested in what was going on there that led to the lack of. I mean, America threw a ton of resources at it, so in some ways, you could question how much it would have mattered if they'd poured even more in, but. It's all bad, basically, is what I'm saying. This is a genuine disaster of American foreign policy.
Good job.
should we talk about something a bit more lighthearted to end this podcast? Should we talk about the Euros?
Yes, I'd like to. I'm just very excited about it. I'm very happy about where the boys have come. It is important to note that... I wouldn't call myself kind of like the biggest football fan day to day. Like, I'm going to say that off the bat. Mainly because it's such a time sink. Like, your whole weekend goes if you want to be up on the football. You know what I mean? I did try during lockdown to, like, really get into... Because I'm a Spurs fan by blood. I don't know why you're laughing at that. It's very serious.
I just enjoyed the by blood phrase.
Yeah. No, I had no choice in the matter. But I just... it's a very time-consuming hobby if you're into football. And also, I don't really enjoy many of the people who like football at the nth degree. Do you know what I mean? I prefer hanging out with people who like watching Drag Race than I do hanging out with people who like football. They're just more generally more fun.
They're more your people, aren't they? The Drag
however,
Race crowd.
However, if England in this campaign have not been the epitome of pageantry, then I don't know What has been?
At what point did you start caring about England's campaign in the Euros? Was
At the beginning. It was a particularly interesting one because we were in the same group as Scotland and then produced probably one of the most boring games ever played. But yeah, I was, from the very beginning, I love international football. I really, really like international football. And some of the, I haven't watched every game of... I don't think that is necessarily obviously, but it is. It's a lot of time to watch every single game.
You're talking about every game of the tournament rather than every England match.
Oh, yeah. I've watched every England match.
Yeah, yeah. I'm just clarifying for the listeners, Jazza. Yeah. So.
Thank you. Oh, okay. Cool. But it's just been brilliant. I love the drama of it. It's real life. It's like somebody wrote some of the matches that have been played.
Mm. And I think one of the... Obviously, I wanted England to beat Denmark, but I think Denmark did have the better story arc, basically.
They do. You know? They do. Do they? We've got 55 years of hurt, Jimmy.
Yeah, but they had...
They've got, what, 2 months of hurt?
They had that player collapsing in the first match, and then they managed to recover from that and make it all the way to the semi-finals. I mean... One of the things that has made me laugh actually slightly is, like, obviously a lot of people have said, oh, you know, wouldn't it be a great end to, like, you know, the COVID pandemic or England's COVID pandemic?
Oh, that would be great if the COVID pandemic was over, wouldn't it?
Well, there's that, but there's also Italy have had a worse time of it than England. So in some ways, they need this win more than
we
do.
Aren't we, in terms of deaths per capita, pretty similar to Italy?
We are quite similar, but I think they're slightly worse. Am I wrong about that?
They were the first... No, they were the first to be hit. But then it has been fine? Question mark.
I think fine's probably overstating it. I think at the very least you could say it would be good for either country to get a win to lift the spirits, right? I don't think England have a unique claim on that.
I think it would be unfair because Italy have already won Eurovision this year.
Hey, they have. God, what a bumpy year for Italy this could be in terms of international tournaments.
High of culture. I think it's our turn. Thank you very much. But you know what? It just makes me... There's obviously the football side of this, but there's also the just loveliness of the England side and the fact that they really piss off all of the twats who are the general stereotypical England fans, who are just like, oh, they're all woke, who boo them taking the knee, who boo other people's national anthems. I just really enjoy how much these guys just playing on the pitch, just being decent and nice.
I do feel
and
like
considered.
The England
pisses
team,
them off.
The England team. I mean, footballers in general are kind of known for being, preening prima donnas on and off the pitch. I do feel that the England team...
Our generation, though, that's like what we know footballers for being.
Yeah.
I think from like the team of the noughties when they were all basically like superstars and models and it was like the Wags on tour and all of that kind of stuff. It was all about fast cars and shaving your armpits. And... And that there seems to have been in footballer culture a correction of that, of kind of like more the wholesome lad who just wants to play football.
Well, Gareth Southgate is quite a wholesome chap, isn't he? And obviously some of that does appear to have filtered down to the rest of, you know, the actual players. So they're a lot more likeable in that sense, I think, than, as you say, previous iterations of England football squads. So that is...
What do you think about the... We've talked about the taking of the knee, but what do you think about their persistence of it? Because most of the other teams in the tournament ended up stopping, whereas England continued, and as far as I know, will continue to do so tonight when they play.
I mean, I don't... I think as a gesture, it is still quite divisive because of some of its less, appealing political connotations. That said, I do always enjoy somebody being stubborn, so I'm kind of enjoying it the more they continue to do it, even in the wake of the booing, which is probably the worst conceivable opinion to have, I think, on both aspects of it.
Who do you think is going to be happier? The liberal readers of The Guardian who actually read the football pages of The Guardian, or the guys who have been booing them this whole time? Probably, who's going to be happier if we win?
Probably the booers, because I think it matters more to them, to be honest with you. I think that there's a kind of slightly affected intellectual appreciation for football among, dare I say it, more middle-class people. And I think there's a bit more of a visceral love of the game.
How can you at me next time, please? Thank you.
Well, yeah, it's just something I'm kind of aware of, is that, you know, there's a lot of slightly prissy people. I feel like this is also going to come across as a direct attack on you, Jazza, but, you know, scolding the fans for not behaving quite as you'd like them to do, you know, singing things like there were, was it the 10 German Bombers song and that kind of thing. Which is funny still, do you know what I mean? Like, I'm very much up for that level of crassness in public life generally and in football specifically.
Nah, but then that stuff goes to, like, the young girl who was, when England beat Germany, which was a really great match, but there was a German girl in the crowd who was crying and in her, like, dad's arms, and it was, like, yeah, she's a German supporter, but she was literally 8, and of course she's gonna cry. And she got, like, anti-German, I don't think you can really call it racist, but, like, abuse,
certainly nationalistic abuse, I would say.
Abuse. That's the reason that very often football turns me off.
Yeah, I think
it isn't the game or the players, it's the people who surround it. Where like, honestly, speaking from kind of like, I'm not feeling safe at a ground, for example. Hearing homophobic or racist chants, for example. I'm a Tottenham fan. I just get used to whenever I watch them play in person. The other team, especially when we're away, the other team make hisses like they're like the gas chamber, because we're seen as the Jewish club.
Yeah,
like, there's really horrific parts of football culture that I just absolutely bloody hate. And the thing that I've really loved in this is kind of like a reclaiming of decency, because that, when I was learning about sports when I was younger and playing sports, the English story of sport that you get told is we created sportsmanship. Like, being decent on the field, shaking hands and being cordial and gentlemanly about it.
I mean, that also fits into some of the stereotypes about how we ran the empire and that kind of thing.
It goes beyond 100%. Sports. But there's that romanticism and it's a part of, like, Englishness that I actually quite like the idea of being decent.
Yeah.
Like, in the face of everything. And that gets completely ripped out by the misbehavior and the prejudice of kind of like a load of these people who come to represent us whenever they travel around the world.
I think the thing is, though, like, and this has been represented by the games, actually, as you say, like, the England fans have booed our team taking the knee, they've booed other people's national anthems, they booed that German girl for crying. I just think a lot of it is just not very sincerely meant. It's just like, you know, booing and laddishness for the sake of it. Do you know what I mean? It's almost like,
yeah, that don't mean it's good.
Well, no, but like,
or tolerable.
But like,
just because lads do it doesn't mean it's fine.
I
didn't mean it, mate. All I did was do like the monkey symbol at Raheem Sterling. Like, all I did was go ooh ooh ooh. Like, that's literally.
I'm not saying it's all good.
Absolute rubbish.
I'm not saying it's all good, but I do agree with the analysis that actually, as football has been like sort of more engaged with by, as I said, prissy middle class people, there has been a certain
pretty. Are you saying prissy? So yeah. Pretty middle class people. well, we've always liked football.
Well, it's just
we're less likely to go to like Madrid to watch them play, I think.
Well, I'm just saying there is a sort of like working class, boisterous element to the game that I think in some ways is looked down on.
You can be boisterous. And also, all of these players, they're working class.
Yes, they are.
Like,
they're
the only middle class footballer that we've ever really had is Frank Lampard.
I feel like you've not let me get to the end of my point, which is that...
Okay, sorry, make your point.
Is that, yes, that, you know, there is this kind of like slightly scolding nature and finger wagging from people like yourself towards people who behave pretty handsome chaps like yourself. You know, down on people who are not, don't get me wrong, they're not behaving in the best way, but I think that a lot of men need actually some kind of outlet to behave in slightly drunken, loutish ways, and you know, to some degree, it is fine. I'm not saying all of it is good, but like people need outlets like that to actually misbehave, and football culture is one of those outlets for many people. Do you know what I mean? So I don't think it should be criticised and censored to the nth degree. I think there's individual aspects of it you can criticise, like, you know, people, you know, calling that girl a slut on Twitter, like the German girl who was crying. And there's people who take it too far, don't get me wrong. But I don't think that all of it should be criticised just because, you know, people who... I mean, it's kind of like rock gigs, right? Like, there's people who want to go in the mosh pit and people who want to stand in an allocated seat space and just watch the music. And there should be room for both of those things in football, is all I'm saying. Jazza is now picking his nails.
I don't have a problem with like being a lad, but there are so many examples, like shining a laser pointer at the at a goalie on the receiving end of penalties, stuff like stuff like calling the spitting on Danish players or booing national anthems and stuff. You can be a lad and not be a dick.
Yes, you can. Yeah, I think there is a you know, line between those two things. But I also think that, you know, maybe we just agree. We're just coming at it from slightly different emphasis. Mm-hmm. Is that fair?
God, I hate that.
Or is that?
Yeah,
is
I hate that. Yeah, sure, maybe. Jimmy, do you this evening? Will you be watching?
I will actually
and
be watching.
Is football indeed coming home?
I'm not a football forecaster. You know, obviously I did call the Batley and Spen by-election correctly, which is something that I haven't gloated over quite as much as I should have done.
You really should have. I do that all the time.
Due to lack of opportunity. But I'm not, as I said, I'm not an expert on football. I think even you said at the start of this podcast, it's about 50-50. Could get like, it's quite evenly balanced. I think that's probably true from the vague analysis that I've read. So I think England, you know, England have a decent chance, but actually I also think that people won't see it this way, but it is still a really good thing that England made it to a final of a major tournament, that actually Gareth Southgate has done really well even just to get this far. And he's a very wholesome man, so that should be celebrated.
I just want to give him a kiss and a cuddle, consensually. like a bro-y kiss, like a... You know.
Maybe he would settle for a manful hug of sorts. Although, until the 19th, you're not allowed to do that, really, are you? So just random strangers.
Do you think we're going to get a bank holiday if we win?
No. Next question. Can't go around just handing out bank holidays. Are we Jeremy Corbyn or something? This is shocking. Shocking, but yeah. People want to work, Jazza. They don't want days off. They don't want leisure time to enjoy themselves and spend time with their families. That's not what people want. They want to work hard. This is a hard-working
Jimmy
country.
Blue Nichols. Christ, shut up.
Where can they find you on the internet, Jazza, if they want to? I mean, obviously, they'll just be in drunken revelries after the football. But, you know, where can they find you, hypothetically?
Jazza John. On all social media platforms, because I am Jimmy Watt.
A good internet boy.
Yes,
you
indeed.
Can tweet me at JDE Nichols. It's not worth giving the email address. No one emails anymore. That just doesn't happen.
Write dishonorable at gmail.com.
Jimmy, or Jimmy at writedishonorable.com, even. One of the two.
Is there a Jazza at writedishonorable.com?
Oh, no, you have to pay a bit extra for that, and I'm not willing. So.
To be fair, I wouldn't use it. Alright. Toodaloo, everybody. It's coming home.
Bye-bye.
It's coming home.
It might come home, possibly.
Shut up! Stop! I want the last words to be, it's coming home.